Gardening can be a real pleasure, but even when we take good care of our plants, nature doesn't always cooperate, and plant diseases are, unfortunately, a fact of life for you and for me. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. For this edition of Garden Talk, we have two very knowledgeable people with us today. Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison's Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, always wonderful to have you with us.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
And Liz Freemuth, previously horticulturist for Walworth County and owner of her business, The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. And she provides concierge horticultural services really around the country. And Liz, great to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me as well.
And certainly all three of us are very saddened by the death of our very good friend, Shelley Ryan. Shelley was a great friend of this program and, of course, her own program. And we're going to talk with among ourselves and probably with you a bit later on in the program about Shelley and her life and her work. I know her pretty well, or knew her pretty well, and I think she would say, Larry, get on with the show for now. And so that's exactly what we're going to do, and we're going to take your questions and comments, and later on in the show we'll have some words about Shelley. But you can join in. Maybe you've had a plant disease. Maybe you're worried about what might come up this year. You have some ideas, or do you want some suggestions for plants or trees that might be disease resistant? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Brian, start with you. What plant diseases did you see the most of at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic last year?
I think the two diseases that stand out most, first is oak wilt. In 2012, mm-hmm. we had basically a difficult time diagnosing that disease. It was so hot and dry in 2012 that I think the fungus actually got kind of cooked in a lot of the trees, and we were not able to culture that organism at all. Last year, we had a bumper crop of oak wilt that we confirmed, over 50 samples, which is a large number compared to even a normal year. And then the other disease that I remember a lot of, and certainly in my own yard here in Madison, was a disease called tar spot. So if you had a Norway maple with a lot of little black areas on the leaves, blotches, and that's tar spot, and it caused a fair number of problems in a variety of areas of the state.
Of course, oak wilt is, that's a deadly disease.
That's a fatal disease, typically in oaks, and we, like I said, saw a ton of it last year. So, and it's a permanent disease here in the state, and we're going to see it continually. So it's one that people should watch for. It causes a dieback in the branches. It's a fungal disease. It's brought in by sap beetles that visit wounded trees and then drop off the fungus. It colonizes the water conducting tissue and blocks it off, and that's what leads to the branch death. And then if you've got a lot of oaks in a grove, then it will move from tree to tree via root grafts.
Yeah. And Liz, I'm wondering about your diseases that you saw in your work.
Out in the field, it's always interesting because there is the what nature is doing and what we're doing on top of nature. And root rot is one of those that we as caring humans exacerbate, because you may start to see a little bit of what might appear to be wilting on the leaves. And so people think, oh, it doesn't have enough water. So they go and water it. And then they, it just exacerbates the problem. But I saw it across the board, what appeared to be root rot symptoms across the board in pines, a lot in pines this year. And oftentimes where I see the most detrimental effects from some of these illnesses, which can be really quite minor when taken care of right away or when conditions are good, it are in recent transplants. So they might be getting a little bit too much water. They might not be getting enough. It might be inconsistent. All of those things play into it. But across the board, then also black knot. Saw a lot of black knot in what are supposedly resistant varieties, and it is what it is, and you just deal with it, cut it out. Brian's poop on a stick,
yeah,
as we like to.
Yeah, that's what I call poop on a stick.
Yeah, and it's so descriptive. People know right away what you're talking about when you go, well, it's this kind of black. Well, does it look like poop on a stick? Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. And so I did see a lot of that. Not much for foliar diseases this year, other than, like Brian had said, tar spot. So across the board, really, we need to be a little bit better about listening to what our plants are saying, and you know, don't just go with what we think they should have, but actually pay attention to what's going on all over.
Yeah. Well, we have, so with that sort of base, let's take a look at what some of our listeners have to say. And again, they're open lines. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Anne in Trempealeau is up first, so let's go to Anne. Hi, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have been dealing with Aster's Yellow for the last few years in my garden, and I keep pulling out my coneflowers and my black-eyed Susans when they come up, because, you know, every year I'm hopeful, but the virus is still in them, and I'm just wondering how many years that takes to get out of the soil, and if I should be trying to, you know, buy some new plants to put in there, or what I could do.
Okay.
Yeah, Aster yellows is what's called a phytoplasma disease, and phytoplasmas are kind of bacteria-like organisms. They're moved around by leafhoppers, and we had a bumper crop of leafhoppers in the state in 2011, and you're probably paying the price of that even now. This is not a soil-borne organism, though. Basically, it's only in the leafhoppers and only in the infected plants. So once you remove the plants and get them out of your garden, you should be able to get that disease under control. The typical symptoms on things like coneflowers and black-eyed Susan will be very green, leafy flowers kind of across the entire flower. If you're looking at a coneflower and see a little bit of green tissue in that cone portion, that could be an insect-related problem on the plant rather than Aster yellows. But if the entire flower looks very leafy and green, then just remove the plant, get rid of it, and you should be fine. You can go ahead and replace those plants pretty quickly right after you remove the old ones.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Luann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I have a stand of peonies that I inherited when I got the house, and I've lived here since 1975, and they're beautiful. They're old. They're established, and last year for the first time, as I was driving, they're along the driveway, and I looked and I thought, good Lord, what's happened to them? They were, and it looked like what you guys call powdery mildew. I mean, I just looked at it and I thought, what in heaven's name? They're all white. They looked like somebody had flocked them for Christmas tree.
Yeah, sprinkled a little talcum powder or some powdered sugar.
Exactly. You know, I thought, you know, if I had any nasty neighbors, that would have been my first thought. But nothing has ever happened to these guys before. They're
sure.
So well established. I don't do anything to them except give them a little bone meal at the end of the season after I cut everything off. But is there anything in the soil? Am I going to have to worry about it for next year?
Yeah, the lucky thing about the powdery mildews are that, in general, they're pretty cosmetic diseases. They don't do a lot of damage to the plants. So all of that kind of white flocking that you're seeing is sporulation of the fungus. On things like peonies, I don't see a lot of underlying leaf mm-hmm. damage from the fungus. You can get some drying on things like mm-hmm. phlox or on cucurbits. If you're growing cucumbers or squash, they tend to be pretty susceptible to the powdery mildew fungi that go to those particular hosts. And there are lots of powdery mildew fungi that are pretty host specific. What I would suggest that you do for your peonies, if you want to try to minimize the disease, is one, good cleanup of old debris. That's where the fungus tends to survive. It, again, is not a soil-borne organism. It will survive in soil, in old plant, little bits of plant debris, but not in just straight soil. So if you can remove as much of that debris as possible, that will help you get it under control. The big driving environmental factor for powdery mildews is humidity in the air. And you mentioned that you just kind of let your peonies mm-hmm. go. And probably what's happened is they've got very large and very dense. And if you've got a lot of foliage like that, that traps a lot of moisture in the air, and that raises the humidity, which makes it more conducive for powdery mildews to develop. So what you may want to consider doing is thinning your plants, dividing them, and then reestablishing them along your driveway and space them farther apart to give them better airflow. Now, if you're absolutely desperate, and I don't typically recommend this in most situations, but if you want some sort of spray treatment, there is kind of a home remedy that's based on some research out of Cornell University. It's a mixture of roughly a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and three tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil, so usually a paraffin-based oil. And you mix that in a gallon of water, and you spray that as a preventative treatment before you see any symptoms. But I think, quite frankly, if you thin them out, I think that'll probably take care of most of your problem.
And you don't want to thin those out until the middle of August from the root. So enjoy those spring blooms. Enjoy
the powdery mildew.
Exactly. Enjoy the foliage. If you want to spray, go ahead. But once the blooms have passed, you can go through and thin out at least a third of those stems that are there. You're going to get plenty of photosynthesis. You will be fine, and that might increase the airflow enough to really prevent you having to spray, if at all possible. Then August 17th is the quote-unquote magic date that we use as the time frame to start playing with the peony roots. So at that point, then I would say dig them up. And, you know, if you have a real affinity for this, for these peonies, and it sounds like you do, you may want to do a little bit of research on how to do that appropriately so you don't kill them. But they're pretty tough. And the main thing with peonies when you dig them up and replant them is if you think you didn't plant them deep enough, you're just fine, because they really only need to be just underneath the soil surface a few inches. If you go any deeper than that, you will get weak stems, you'll get weak roots, etc. So one website that has some fantastic information on peonies, because they are peony growers for generations, is Song Sparrow Farm. And they're out of Janesville area. They are peony growers extraordinaire, and they have fantastic information on their website.
And I see you're from Green Bay, so you have local extension help there as
Absolutely.
Well. Absolutely. BJ Pandian is your agent up there, and I would also contact him for additional information as well.
Yeah. And you might want to think about it. You know, VJ is up there doing an excellent job. You might want to think about maybe donating some of those peonies that you dig if you don't have enough of them, enough space in your own yard. Donate them to a plant sale, a Master Gardener plant sale or something like that. The Botanic Garden may be interested in having some of those things as a plant sale.
Luann, thank you so much. Appreciate your call very, very much. Talking about identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases today with our two guests, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology, Liz Freemuth, who is the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She does concierge horticultural services here in Wisconsin, but actually across the country as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking plant diseases today with our guests, Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. Mentioned at the start of the show that Shelley Ryan, as most of you know, as the with her wonderful show on television and appearing with me many, many times, passed away yesterday morning at 9, I think around 9 o'clock, of breast cancer. We'll be talking about her later on in the show, a little bit about her life and work. But we do have a post on my Facebook page. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show, there's a story about Shelley. There's actually an interview that she did with Brian that we posted up on the Facebook page and somewhere, and just as a kind of a tribute to her. And if you would like to leave a message, we've already had, I don't know how many, 30 or so thereabout messages have been left. I think it would be something nice for us to see, but also for Shelley's husband, Danny, and son, Kelly. So we'd appreciate that, too. And certainly we appreciate your questions, as I said as well. She would be saying, Larry, get going with these questions. Come on. It's Garden Talk. So we're going to do that right now and go to Stacy and Nina, who has our next question. Hi, Stacy. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be talking about plants and green stuff today.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it?
We need it, don't we?
Yeah.
It's snowing again.
It's been a long winter already.
Yeah.
I know. Can't really be done with it yet, though. It's only January.
Exactly.
So my question is about a sugar maple that is in our backyard. It turned later this year, which I noticed all around the valley, so I don't think it was unusual that way, but it didn't. When you said oak wilt, I got nervous, and then I remembered it's not an oak. It's a maple, but usually it turns a little red at the top, and then the turning starts to move down the tree. And this year, the leaves at the top, rather than turning red, they turned brown and started curling up. Mm-hmm. And eventually, the bottom of the tree, the leaves kind of turned red and fell, but there were fewer leaves this year, and it did that weird drying, curling thing, and it was, I don't know, it wasn't as pretty this year, and it was a little bit scary.
How old is your maple tree?
I don't know. We've only been living in the yard about 3 years,
is
so
it
we
a
really
pretty,
don't have too much to compare it to.
How big are
pretty
own,
good
yeah.
size?
How tall, maybe?
I missed the question.
Oh, is it tall? How tall it might be? Is it 15 feet or 20 or?
Maybe 15. Yeah.
Okay. Fair sized trunk.
Okay. And anything else? You've only been there for 3 years, so you really don't have a long history to see what has been going on with it. But have you noticed any branches dying back at all, or has it looked pretty good other than it did something wonky this fall?
Yeah, kind of. It's primarily at the top of the tree where you were seeing the kind of unusual symptoms.
Yep. No, yeah. There aren't branches falling off of it, and there's tons of squirrels on it, so it's not like they're breaking branches off. And it had the little helicopter thingies that they ate, and everything else was really normal.
Yeah, what I'm suspicious of with a maple tree, we see a lot of what are called girdling roots on maples, particularly sugar in Norway. We'll have problems with that. And those are roots that will grow around the trunk of the tree. They can be at the surface. They may be underground. Oftentimes they develop if the tree was initially planted a little bit too deeply. And what that tends to do is the trunk gets larger in diameter. It reaches those roots and they kind of strangle the tree. They constrict the water conducting tissue, and that limits water flow up to the top of the tree. So you kind of get this relatively uniform kind of early fall color and or browning of the leaves as you've described. There is a disease similar to oak wilt that can occur in maples called verticillium wilt, but with that disease, what I would expect would be kind of a sectional dieback.
And in July, not in fall.
Yeah, and it sounds, because it's more uniform across the top of the tree, that it may be this kind of girdling root issue. You can get very similar symptoms as well if you have kind of drought stress on the tree. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly a possibility as well. Liz mentioned root rots earlier. Sometimes if you get root rots, you can get more of a general kind of dieback at the top of the tree. But my first suspicion is girdling roots. And what I would do is check for those along the ground. You may want to dig a little down along the trunk and see if you see any roots that are kind of circling the trunk.
Well, and what I would suggest, too, before you start digging around is, do an honest assessment of how comfortable are you, because if you're not comfortable taking a look at this, this is the time to call a certified arborist in, because they have the tools to actually blow the air out, as opposed to using a fork or a shovel like we would use, the normal person, to get that soil out of there. And you can actually cause more damage on the roots than by digging around trying to find what's going on, than if you would let somebody come in. What I would look for as you walk around the tree is look for relatively flat spots on the trunk. And oftentimes that's a signal that you have that girdling root underneath. And you will notice, you look at it, the tree is not going to be in the shape of a D. It shouldn't be. Normally, trunks on maples are not in the shape of a D. So you wouldn't have, normally, if the roots are healthy, a flat spot in any one area. So, look around at that. And oftentimes you can't see them. If the tree has been there for a while, you can actually see them start to come up and out of the ground be very close to the surface.
I have a maple in my yard that has girdling roots, and they're right at the surface. So you may be able to see them very, very easily. And Liz is quite correct. If you're not comfortable doing this, get a certified arborist. If you type in Wisconsin Arborist Association onto the internet, you'll get to their website.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone who's interested, it's www.waa-isa.org, and you can search by county and look for certified arborists in your area.
And they even allow you to look for people who specialize in root issues.
Right.
So, you know that they're going to have the equipment to handle what you need to do. Also, finding an arborist is like finding a doctor.
Very true.
You need to really be comfortable with them, because you are going to have to trust what they are going to do. So it may take you a couple just to find that that really good relationship that you need to have with your arborist.
And a certified arborist.
Certified arborist, definitely. And lots of fantastic people out there, and lots of good things that can happen. I myself am a certified arborist, and I would not take on digging around roots in somebody else's yard. In my own, yes, I do. But because the equipment really does need to be specialized to not do damage, I would not do that for somebody else. So you do need to find a good one.
Thanks, Stacy. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Philip in Trempealeau, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Phil. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. Good morning. I have a question about oak wilt. I've got an oak tree that's massive in my front yard. It's 13 feet in circumference and 50 feet from drip line to drip line. And we always worry that oak wilt's going to get to it. It's pretty isolated. There aren't any really other oak trees for, you know, a couple hundred feet in my neighbor's yard. But do we need to do anything about the branches that I see in the upper reaches of the tree that are dying off? Is that a sign of the oak wilt? Because
it's possible.
Been like that for decades.
Okay, if it's been a long-term sort of thing, then unlikely it's oak wilt, because that tends to be a fairly rapidly developing disease, and it will usually kill the tree in very short order.
Again in July.
Yeah, usually during the summer. Yeah.
You will see symptoms in July.
And sometimes with oaks like red oaks, those oaks with the pointed lobes, they tend to die very rapidly. They can die within a single growing season. White oaks, the ones with the rounded lobes, tend to hang out a little bit longer with the disease, but it does eventually kill them as well. So it's probably not an oak wilt that you're dealing with that's causing the branch dieback. This would be another situation where I'd really encourage you to call in a certified arborist to come in and do some pruning of those branches.
Now's the time to prune.
And oh,
pruning
it is,
in the winter
before March.
We definitely do not recommend pruning oak trees during the growing season, because that's when sap beetles are active, and that's what can bring in the oak wilt fungus. And there's some research to indicate that sap beetles can visit a wounded oak tree within 10 minutes.
Yes.
So it's very, very rapid. If you ever do need to prune for some reason, you've had storm damage, you need to prune branches off of an oak tree, then you really need to be out there with pruning paint immediately to cover those wounds to make them less attractive to the insects. But now, in the middle of the winter, is a great time to prune.
And, you know, we have that March to, and it used to be April to September. I say don't even do it in March. It's like March to October is when you really have to start watching what the insect activity is in order to monitor how to do that, you know, when to plan your pruning. Also, there is a lot of natural death that does occur in trees. And so if this is just a continuation of what you've seen for quite some time, then I don't know as if I would be tremendously worried about it either. But now is the time to prune it. Getting that dead stuff out, depending on where the tree is really good for your homeowner's insurance, because you want to minimize any risk that is going to happen from those branches up high falling, even if it's a natural occurrence. So having somebody come out there and do it or do it yourself is a good thing.
And having those branches fall off and breaking where they want to break, which can potentially open up healthy tissue in the middle of the summer, that can increase your likelihood of oak wilt. So it's best to get it pruned out.
And oftentimes with the larger trees, we tend to forget that they do need shaping as well. So you do need to get out there and minimize it and actually balance out the load of those limbs, so that when we start looking at spring storm season, you have minimized your risk for all of the above-mentioned damage.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Phil.
Well, the village is real good about not trimming it over the streets until November, December. So
very good.
We've been keeping an eye on that. Yeah.
And as long as you're not seeing that wilting and dieback in your neighbor's trees, I don't know that I would worry about it tremendously in yours either. You're not going to have the beetles spreading it, and the roots are probably interconnected if they're of similar age somewhere. But if you're not seeing a problem in yours, or you're not seeing a problem in your neighbor's, you should be okay.
200 feet, which you mentioned is the distance between your tree and your neighbor's, doesn't sound like a big distance, or sounds like a big distance to you, but for a tree root system, it's not. Those trees, if they're the same type of oak, are probably root grafted. So the other thing you might want to consider, if you're really concerned about keeping this tree healthy long term, there are injection treatments that you could consider as preventative treatments to try to keep the disease in check if it should enter the area. The downside to those is that you have to do them about every other year, and they can be quite expensive. But that's something, again, that you should consult about with an arborist about whether that's the right thing for you to do.
And you also open that tree up. You're creating a wound where whenever you go into that tree, and has to be treated during early in the growing season.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's the pros and cons to all
definitely.
Of it, which, you know, really in the Madison area, you've got some fantastic tree companies that do wonderful work on oak wilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're up in Trempealeau?
Trempealeau.
Yeah, there's certainly arborists up in that area
Absolutely.
As well who could help you out as well.
If there's trees, there's guys with saws.
That's right.
Thanks, Philip. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Mary in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was listening earlier, and I caught the end of the Aster Yellows info, and I've been dealing with that for a couple of years in my yard as well as in some friends' yard, and I have a question about that. We took them all out of my yard, but there are neighbors in the area that don't get it, so they still have plants. So if they don't take theirs out and I replant, what's the chances of being reinfected? I mean, I know the mm-hmm. hoppers.
Right, leafhoppers are the what's called the
it.
Yeah, leafhoppers are what are called the vector. So that's the insect that moves the phytoplasma around, and it will really depend upon the leafhopper aster leafhopper population in your area. So if you would get a larger influx of those insects into your location, then they could potentially pick up the phytoplasma from your neighbor's plants and then transmit them to your plants. So I would really try to talk to your neighbors again, try to educate them. We do have a very nice fact sheet on that particular disease, and if you're interested in downloading it, it's available on my website.
Quite a bit about it, mm-hmm. And talk to some different people, but I wasn't as clear about the insect itself, mm-hmm. you know, and how far they travel, and even if I were to take those plants came out in the spring, and they'd all... How soon in the season do these hoppers get out there?
It can vary. They tend to blow up from the south. They don't overwinter here. So we're talking about populations that are moving from the southern parts of the United States into our area. They usually arrive every year for the most part. And it's just that a couple of years ago, we had a huge, very early influx of those insects, and they happen to be a larger proportion than normal, were actually carrying the phytoplasma. That's why we had pretty serious problems. Although my understanding was even farther north in Canada, it was even worse. They had potato crops that were substantially affected by aster yellows. So again, it varies from year to year what size of population of that insect you're going to see coming up into the area.
Mm-hmm. All right, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. And Stu in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Stu.
Hello there. Last year, I lost a red bud due to what you guys told me was some sort of fungus in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably verticillium.
And what I'm wondering, I want to replace it with a serviceberry. Is that ground contaminated that wouldn't work? Or
I would expect the ground to have some of the fungus in it. And serviceberry is a tree that, or shrub, depending upon the variety that you get, that I oftentimes recommend to put into a location where there's been a problem with verticillium. It is not technically totally immune to the disease, so there have been reports of that particular fungus infecting serviceberry, but it's a tree where I don't think I've ever had a sample of a serviceberry come in to my lab that has tested positive for verticillium. There are reports in the literature, but I do not consider it a good host for that fungus. So I think it's a nice tree to put in a site where you've had a problem with that disease.
I have not had problems out in the field either. You can pop a serviceberry in almost anywhere, and it will do really good.
And they're
really
lovely, lovely trees.
They are.
I love
gorgeous.
Them.
Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest getting one that, if you like eating off of your yard, get one that is known for its berries or for the blooms. Forest Prince is one that I put in that is absolutely absolutely beautiful where it blooms all along the stem. Mm-hmm. And the berries are really nice. But you really have to almost, you know, I'm sorry, bird lovers, beat the birds off with a stick in order to get to the berries.
They
because
love those
just
berries.
As they're starting to turn, as you know, you get up in the morning and think, oh, I'll have a little on my cereal. No way. They're gone. They're gone completely. Okay. But it is a fantastic tree. And you can do multi-stem, single stem. There's just lots to choose from out there.
Well, is there a certain variety that does best in the Madison area?
I think I have not had problems with serviceberry at all, from what I can tell. It seems to be a pretty tough tree.
It's tough.
The only disease I think I've ever seen on serviceberry was a little bit of cedar apple rust, or one of the cedar apple rust variants, and that was just a very rare occurrence. I was quite surprised when the sample came in.
Yeah, I've tried. I have not been able to give mine cedar apple rust, so it's been pretty good. And I really, this last year, I saw quite a bit of rust, even in my own yard, and not on the serviceberry.
Yeah, it seems
they
to be
actually
a very tough tree.
Again, I like forest. I'm pretty sure it's Forest Prince. I'm pulling that out of the back of my gray matter. But that one is a really, really nice one. It does very well. It's not as fast a grower as some of them, but it is a good performer, and it does just fine north of Madison.
Yeah, the other thing I would do, since you're in the Madison area, would be give Lisa Johnson a call at Dane County Extension. She's incredibly knowledgeable on woody ornamentals, and she could provide you with some suggestions in terms of varieties as well.
And actually where to get them, because, you know, we can tell you I can tell you what varieties work really well, but whether they're actually available in your local garden center is another matter. But right now is a good time to figure all of this stuff out and then get to your local garden center, because they're happy to do what will make you happy as a client. So they want to hear what you want so they can go out and find them. And we're doing the commercial shows right now, so now is the time to tell your local garden centers what you want so that they can purchase them when they're out and about.
And thanks a lot for calling, Stu. Trish and Thorpe, we give you a chance next. Hi, Trish. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have recently, my husband and I purchased a family farm 4 years ago. We're officially 112 years now. And in our back 40, we have a small growth of about 80 to 100 white oak trees. Significantly old grove. I would assume they're probably pushing 100 years old. We have started to allow some young oaks to grow and hope to rejuvenate this grove because, you know, it's getting up there, and some of them are starting to deteriorate. My fear is this oak wilt. I hate to beat the oak wilt to death, but is there anything you can do that's preventative? Or do you wait until you get it, and then I'm assuming it's not treatable. Is this correct?
Yeah, for the grove.
How many acres did you say you have?
It's on an 80 acre.
Okay.
Yeah, you've got a large number of trees.
Yeah, but it's in a very small grove. It's very secluded. There is no neighboring trees. I would say they're probably an acre away is probably the nearest grove of trees. So it is very secluded, and it is strictly all white oak.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing
That's
else in there.
They tend to be less susceptible, although, again, it's a fatal disease even in white oaks. You know, we talked about injection treatments. I would not recommend that for you. You're dealing with a grove of trees that would be cost prohibitive, and I don't think it's something you want to get into anyway. Mm-hmm. The main thing would be to watch the trees. If you get any storms that come in and cause any sort of damage, I would be out there immediately. If you see wounds and can get to them, paint over the wounds as quickly as you possibly can. With groves, it's really, really difficult because there are usually so many trees that trying to keep track of all of them and any damage is going to be very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
If you're working in the grove, you've got to be very careful to not accidentally wound the tree during the growing season, because that wound can be attractive to the insects as well. So again, I would tend to, if you're going to do any sort of pruning or that sort of thing, now it is the time of year to do it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry at this time of the year about using pruning paints, but that would be something that you would want to think about if you have damage on the trees during the summer, or if for some reason you have to go out and prune a branch, paint over the wound.
And, you know, really with a grove that size, when you're looking at some of the other preventative measures that are used, trenching, things like that,
right,
it's going to be cost prohibitive.
Something you tend to do after the fact. It's
exactly.
Not something you do right now.
And with a grove, you can't really do that anyway because all of those trees are interconnected. So by the time you actually notice that something is going on, it's already gone where it's going to go. And so really you are left with really monitoring what's going on and just doing some good preventative health measures as opposed to reactive.
Yeah. What I would suggest is, are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes.
Yeah, let me give you a website. There's an excellent publication kind of designed for folks who have oak groves. It's at our UW Extension Publications website, and that's Learning Store, all one word, learningstore.uwex.edu. And if you type G3590 in the search line, that brings up a publication called Oak Wilt Management, What Are the Options? And that's a very excellent publication on oak wilt and management, particularly designed for folks who have oak groves. So I think that would be very appropriate for you to get a copy of that. You can read it online or print it out on your home printer if you want to, but it's a nice publication. It's worth the $3 or $4 that it costs to get a hard copy from the publication's office.
Yeah. I just hate to see us lose them after all this time. And it was kind of we just lost my father-in-law a year ago. And this was kind of his pride and joy. He loved the oak grove, and he always had the thought, you know, like maybe we could build a house down there, put a little cabin in there. But we pretty much bale around the whole grove, so around it, it's groomed with hay fields.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much left to grow naturally. We do do some brush hogging in there just to prevent some of the overgrowth. It's just kind of a fun little hobby area.
Sure.
If you do go to the extent of in your care plans of hiring a certified arborist who specializes in oaks, make sure that you articulate these same points to that professional as well, and also articulate your budget to them as well, because you know it's that can get to be quite costly. And while you do want to protect it, and there is a lot of sentimental value. Even sentiment has a price. And so you need to be very, very clear with anybody that you bring in that this is what you're looking for. This is what you can spend on it, what you're willing to spend on it. And then have that realistic dialogue of what can we do and what can't we do.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Trish, appreciate your call. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. One of our guests, the other, Liz Freemuth, who previously horticulturist for Walworth County and now the owner of the Garden Ho, Concierge Horticultural Service. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening in for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guests Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth, and they are here to answer your questions as we visit with them about identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Matt in Brainerd, Minnesota has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Matt, hi.
Hi,
thanks.
Guys.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Yep, I bought a house about 3 years ago. I had a beautiful variety of plants, lilac, raspberries, a bunch of trees. On one side of the garage, I have a gigantic wild rose bush. And I keep getting this little growth on the leaves, like a little brown nodules on the leaves. I just wonder if there's anything wrong with the plant, or is that fairly normal?
It is probably, without looking at it, I would say if it's a nodule on the leaf, does it look like it's just resting on it, or does it disform the entire leaf?
It doesn't really deform. It looks like it's just resting on it.
Okay. More than likely, it's just an insect gall, and depending on what it looks like is what you would do for a treatment. But for the most part, insect galls are cosmetic.
Yeah.
It just consider it an added ornament. More than likely, you will see an increase in the presence of them, then you will see a decrease because it will fall in cycles. And so you may actually have caught it this last year. It might have been the high point, and it might really yeah. go down to where you don't have a lot to worry about. Oftentimes, mites or wasps will be the cause. Without looking at it, can't tell you for sure. But that's generally...
We had a big wasp problem last year, so...
It's not the typical wasp that you see. These are tiny, tiny
yeah,
insects.
They're little. They're okay. very, very tiny. And in order, if it is something that you would want to treat for, in order to do that, you have to find out and you have to take a look at lots of pictures or take it into... an extension office to have it ID'd, ID what the gall is, what is forming it, and then understand the life cycle of that insect in order to understand when you can control so that you don't get that gall on there. That is actually the end of the life cycle. That's where the new ones are going to grow. That's the egg sac, basically, for want of a better term.
Typically, we don't even recommend treatment, because they're very cosmetic. So,
And I actually think they're kind of cool. I mean, once you know what they are, then it's sort of like, oh, okay, I don't have to worry about this. And you can watch to see what's going to happen with it, what's going to occur. Generally not an issue with them.
There you go. Thanks, Matt, for calling. Sue in Mequon. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about, I have a lot of small bur oaks and swamp whites in my yard. And this last fall I noticed they were just, lots of the branches were just full of brown, woody, pea-sized galls that, from my internet research, seem to be made by some kind of wasp. The recommendation on the internet was that I cut these branches off, but I don't think I'm going to have any tree left.
What do I do? It's a cosmetic
problem,
kind of similar to what we were talking about on the roses before, and it's a cosmetic issue. I would not go to that extreme, quite frankly, because the insect is gone at this point.
Yeah, and it can
ignore it.
Exactly. Yeah. And it can impact tree growth when the trees are very young. I have an oak tree that I have galls on horribly in my own yard, and it's about 20 feet away from other oak trees. They don't have it. So that tree is obviously a little more under stress from where it is. I would expect that. I think I ran it over with the lawnmower once or twice, too, in its early life. But it has a huge population of galls on it. And I can see the difference in the branch sizes as it was growing. Now that it's about 15 feet tall, there's not so much of a difference. The new growth comes out just fine. The galls are not quite as much of a problem. If you really are thinking you have nothing better to do, you can go and pick them off. But I think that's really just for your own OCD and nobody else's, because it's not going to do anything for it. As Brian said, they're gone.
Yeah, and quite frankly, you need to gain a healthy tolerance of galls on oaks, because oaks get lots of them. They aren't necessarily all in the branches like the ones you're seeing. The leaves oftentimes are loaded with galls as well. So it's something you're going to see.
And I actually can appreciate a lot of those things that happen to the leaves, because what it tells me is that I have a healthy environment where there's all kinds of organisms living in my plants. And, you know, if you didn't have that, if you had that picture perfect leaf every single year, why? I mean, what is going wrong in your yard that you have no insects, that you have no diseases? So I consider it a good, good, good hug to the environment.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Sue. And Greg and Stoddard, it's your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hi. How you doing, folks?
Great.
Interesting show, and I'm kind of going to go reverse, and maybe I'm wrong. We have we have a farm, 180-some acres. It hasn't had cattle since 1999. We have oak forests all throughout, and underneath of this oak forest is becoming this entirely impenetrable jungle of multiflora rose.
Yeah.
And so, in the reverse part, I'm asking about is, you know, of any diseases that kill that?
Yeah,
I don't have to chemicalize it.
There actually is a disease, and I have to be very careful as I talk about this, because these sorts of controls are a double-edged sword. There's been some work with a disease called rose rosette. It's considered a viral disease. I'm not quite sure if they've actually totally verified that or not, but it's moved around by a certain type of mite, the organism, and it's pretty lethal to multiflora rose. You can get very, very good control of that particular plant using this particular disease. And what people have done is simply found a shrub with the disease, chopped out some of the branches that will hopefully have some of the mites, and tie them to multiflora rose shrubs, and just kind of let the mites and the pathogen do their thing. The downside is that some types of cultured roses that you really want to have around can be susceptible as well. Mm-hmm. So,
of course.
So you've got to be a little bit careful. If basically all you're dealing with in your area is just multiflora rose, it might potentially be an option. What county are you in, Greg?
Vernon County.
Yeah, that's where they've done actually a fair amount of work in the southwest part of the state. Mm-hmm. So you might want to touch base with Tim Rabine, who's your...
Oh, I know. Sure.
Yeah, I would give him a call and see if he's been involved in any of the work that's been done in that area and talk this over with him, because there was some work in the southwest about doing this for multiflora rose.
And, you know, just as another reiteration of Brian's caution, his double-edged sword, do recall that gypsy moths were brought in as a positive control. Japanese beetle was brought in as a, yes, and the Asian lady beetle brought in as a positive control. So we do want to say, yes, you know, go with something that is researched and has a good bit of background to it so that you can really tell what's going to happen down the line.
And if Tim's himself is not familiar with the work that's been done here, he could also contact Mark Rentz, who's one of our weed specialists. And I know Mark is aware of this research, and he may have actually been involved with it. And Tim can get in contact with him on the UW-Madison campus and get some more info for you. But I think it's worth a shot to investigate that a little bit further.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we went to the La Crosse Farm Show yesterday, and besides seeing Jerry Apps, we didn't learn anything about multiflora rose, because they all suggested, I think, something called Taldrin. But you have to spray it and then cut it down. And
it's an herbicide. That's an herbicide. Yeah. And again,
if
you know, Tim talks to Mark and Mark thinks this is a reasonable way to go, I think it's to a certain extent, much less environmentally problem than using some of the herbicides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we were so sad to share the news that our dear friend and colleague Shelley Ryan passed away on Thursday at 9 a.m. Many of you watched her as the Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television over the last 20 years. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And I know that my listeners certainly loved it when she joined us for Garden Talk. She was often a guest on Garden Talk, and then I had her host the show a few times as well, although I must say she said she did not enjoy having to work with the board and turning the microphones on and off. And she said, there's too much of that. There's too much of that. Oh, my goodness. So anyway, I know we have a link on our Facebook page to the lovely tribute that Wisconsin Public Television posted. And I certainly would encourage you to leave your own thoughts and memories of Shelley there. Just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll certainly make sure that her husband, Danny, and her son, Cabley, we'll get those. And Brian, you were a close friend and colleague of Shelley.
I did a lot of episodes for her, and it was really lovely to work with her. I remember my first one. That was way back when I had a lot more hair and not as gray. And I was terrified to do a filming like this because I'd never done television before, and I was just had been hired in my current position. And so it was pretty nerve-wracking for me prepping for it. It was on powdery mildews. We did it at the D.C. Smith Greenhouses, and she was wonderful. She made me feel really, really comfortable, and I had a wonderful time doing it. And I think she sensed that. We got along really well because we would give each other all kinds of grief, and it was really fun to kind of gang up on her with her filming crew as well, because then we'd give her all kinds of a hard time. So we ended up, I think, doing 13 or 14 segments together. So it was a wonderful, wonderful relationship with her.
The thing I remember most about Shelley is that you could see her absolute delight in what she was doing on her face.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, she just shone. And I used to show up when they would do segments down in the southeast portion with Phil. I used to show up with Phil and be off camera. And it just, her delight was just infectious.
Yeah.
Absolutely infectious.
And she had that impish little smile.
Yes. Kind of devilish. Kind of devilish.
The way her eyebrow jumped up or went up when she had something kind of sneaky or devilish on her mind.
She could give it as much as taken. Oh, I mean, it was so fun playing back and forth with her.
Well, and I recall one that was probably not that long ago. They were doing a segment on butterflies down in one of the state parks, and she was going through puddles that had all these little butterflies, not what they were doing the segment on, but I mean, she was just giggling like a schoolgirl, and it was just so fantastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic.
Well, she was a lot of fun for me to work with, and of course, we've got Garden Expo coming up, and she was... She started Garden Expo, and mm-hmm. it was her idea. She had to kind of talk administration at the time into it. And I think the first one was held right in Vilas Hall in the basement. And I don't know if you were around for that one.
Phil Pelletier, I'm not that ancient in extension, but I shouldn't put it that way. But Phil, who's my colleague in the diagnostic world, had told me about doing it in the basement of Vilas Hall. So.
Well, it wouldn't have been that long before you started.
No, about 5 years or so, because I've been around for about 15.
Because I think at that time I was horticulturist and did help out with selling tickets and things like that down by us, maybe for year four. I think that would have been about the time when I met Shelley.
And now we have 20,000 people
That's
showing
right.
up for...
It's a huge event.
And she and I... did a little thing together for years and years, and this year it's going to be Lisa Johnson and I are going to be doing a little something together, so I'm looking forward to that, but also with quite a bit of sadness that Shelley's not going to be with us. As Amy said on our Facebook page, she was a fine and knowledgeable lady, always generous with her expertise. Brian said, what a wonderful symbol of Wisconsin. Nathan said she had a great way to show us and teach us so much. And certainly, as Kari said, we're going to miss you, Shelley Ryan. So it's going to be going to be tough.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Shelley Ryan, for all that you have done for us. And we really appreciate and will always remember Shelley Ryan. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. A lot of us really love getting out and getting our hands dirty in the garden. Some plants seem to grow well no matter what. Others are very susceptible to pests and disease. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk. Liz Freemuth, previously a horticulturist for Walworth County, the owner of The Garden Ho, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticultural services around the country. And Liz, great to have you back.
Oh, thanks so much.
And Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Path. Brian, always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me again.
And we want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Did you have a plant disease this last year? You have some questions about what diseases did you deal with in your garden? Do you have some favorite trees or shrubs or ornamentals that might be problematic? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Jill emailed us and says, I have a grouping of raspberries in my garden that have been quite healthy, but last year in the summer, the leaves turned very light green and did not look very healthy. Is the plant just stressed, do you think, or lacking something?
Could be a fertility issue.
It could. Normally when all over the leaves turn light green on raspberries, it is a fertility issue. Yeah. And, you know, I'm curious as to where she's calling from, because some parts of listening area, you know, however wide that is, had way too much water, and that can actually impact the uptake of nutrients and the availability depending on what
bleaching.
Washed through. Yeah, exactly. So that may have had something to do with it. I would look along the canes over winter to see if you've got any kind of cankers that are showing up that might have come on, not because the leaf color issue is caused by any type of canker, but that it might be weakened and it might be susceptible to them. So just check those over very carefully. And I would say If they have not been fertilized, give them a good fertilizing as appropriate, you know, as determined by a soil sample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. Our soil and plant analysis lab through UW Extension can do testing of a soil.
Yep.
And also, if you start to see leaf symptoms, again, you can send in a leaf sample. They can do a comparison of what's in the soil, what's in the plant, and then provide recommendations on fertility. And again, you can get information on where to send the sample through your county extension office.
Yeah, and you know, one thing to look for is whether those veins are dark green and whether the tissue is light green or is it an all-over light green color. And that's something to make a note of for yourself, even as you move into this new season, as to what you're going to look for as the result might be from that. When the veins are dark, then you've got an uptake issue, definitely, where you're not getting iron up into the plant. And that can really be caused by pH, water, you know, too much, too little, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep, so, bunch of stuff.
Yep, lots of stuff to look for.
Mary in Costco, thank you for calling. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hey, I took, last year I lost 12 full flats of impatiens to the mildew, and it was diagnosed by the I took to the extension. Can you tell me if they are making any improvements? Can I put down some kind of fungicide? I really have a hard time thinking of any other plants that could take up the amount of space that I plant with the impatiens, but it's not even been 1 year, and they said I shouldn't plant for 2 years after that hitting my garden.
Yeah, you're a homeowner and you're just planting these as ornamental. You're not a grower.
Correct.
Okay. I would go, if you want to put something in that's like an impatiens, but not one that's susceptible to the downy mildew, you could go with New Guinean patients. They seem to be relatively resistant / tolerant of this particular disease. So that's a possibility. That'll be something that looks like more traditional impatiens. I would really suggest diversifying, though, and planting a variety of shade-tolerant annuals in that area rather than doing a whole bed of the same plant. You run the risk anytime you're planting a lot of anything of running into a disease problem that'll wipe everything out. So one of the ways that you can prevent having everything wiped out is to plant a variety of different types of plants in an area. So diversity is key to prevent a lot of diseases.
Thank you very much for calling, Mary. Connie in Oshkosh, you have a question.
Yes, I'm hoping the guests can identify an invasive species that I see out in the countryside. It blossoms in middle of August with these tall silver green flower pods, and I thought it must be the invasive kudzu I hear so much about. But later when I looked at a local stand, I found that it had like bamboo stalks on it and not a vine at all.
Could be bamboo.
Yeah, it could be.
Oh, it's probably, my guess is probably Japanese knotweed or some variant on that. If it has a bamboo sort of look, does it have kind of elongated heart-shaped leaves?
Yes.
Okay, it could be Japanese knotweed.
It could be. Is there a little bit of a bend to that joint in the stem?
Oh, I didn't look at it that closely, but it grows real tall with all the fence rows getting to be in the countryside, farm after farm.
Okay, now it doesn't look like a grass. It actually looks like a leafy plant.
Well, it's got so many leaves, it practically covers the stem part. And like I say, it grows 4 or 5 feet or taller, and that stem does look kind of like a bamboo type thing, not a vine like I was expecting kudzu to be.
Yeah, I would say, I agree with Brian, probably, it sounds like it may be a knotweed. But what I would suggest is the DNR does have some good pictures of invasive species, and so I would go to the DNR website and look in the invasive area.
The other thing I would do would be if you see it again next year, just clip off a branch and take it into your county extension office, and they can help you get a positive ID on it. If it is that Japanese knotweed, that's a horrible, horrible plant, very invasive and difficult to deal with. I have some of that in my own yard that I'm combating all the time. At first, when I heard you make the description, I almost thought we had a lot of wild cucumber that was blooming like crazy last year.
Yeah, they do actually have a nice elongated bloom.
But that's
bloom
more of a vine.
It is, so. But if it was crawling up stuff, that would have to be a lot of stuff that's up.
Yeah, and that is really close. White yep. flowers
it was
and masses.
Everywhere.
It was beautiful in a way.
It was so
it was
prolific
crawling
this
up
year, wasn't it?
It was growing up
yeah.
everything.
Yep. Yep. I don't think I've seen it that heavy for probably 15 years. Yeah. It was
an amazing
fantastic.
Year.
Yep.
But look, again, I would get a sample into the county, your county extension office, and have them, you know, get an ID. Again, if they don't know what it is, we have weed experts here that they can tap into in Madison to help get an ID.
And you might just go online and take a look at some of the pictures, but look yep. up Japanese knotweed. You're going to see a lot of pictures.
Of that, yes.
And the DNR has done a wonderful job of trying to identify and give some control methods for invasives in the state. So check their website, too.
Thanks, Connie. Heidi in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I planted some tomatoes this year, and the beefsteaks and the cherry tomatoes were fine, but the Roma tomatoes were kind of mutated, and the ones that did develop, before I could, you know, they'd turn red, and then the end, or even when they were still green, the end where the, not where they attached to the vine, but where the flower is, would turn black and mushy.
Yeah, so on the bottom of that fruit, they were turning kind of rotting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's most likely something called blossom end rot. This is actually a fertility problem on tomatoes, and Romas oftentimes have more exacerbated problems with that than some other types of varieties.
Well, and our tomatoes had a wicked year this year because of the high temps. You know, it came at a time when they should be blossoming and pollinating and getting pollinated, and it was just, we ran into some horrible issues with the tomatoes this year.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
With blossom end rot, it's technically not a disease. It's a fertility issue. It's the fruits don't have enough calcium in them, and it's a calcium uptake issue. So a couple of things that you need to do. One would be make sure that the plants have sufficient calcium at the time of planting. You may need to amend your soil a little bit with something like bone meal to up the calcium. And then you need to be really, really careful that they're getting good uniform watering.
Yeah.
Particularly as they begin to bloom, it's really critical that it's uniform. You don't want them to get too dry, and you don't want them to cycle through wet and dry periods either. It's got to be relatively uniform, and that can help in terms of alleviating this uptake problem with the calcium.
And that actually means that we have to modify our watering,
right?
Because when it gets to be so hot, you know, we program ourselves to go, okay, I'm going to go out and water, and you do that every day or twice a day, what have you, and you forget that when the temperatures are so high, it needed water 2 hours ago. It didn't need it when you had time for it. It needed it when it needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do have to adjust your watering technique and timing on those things when the heat comes.
And if you can get some drip hoses, that might be an option for you to get more uniform watering, or a soaker hose. And
I only had 6 plants.
Okay.
So I was just wondering, but thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. You know, I had the best luck with the tomatoes I had in a straw bale. And I think it was because I was really conscious of the fact that it wasn't a straw bale. And so I paid a lot more attention on the fertility side and the watering and everything. Wonderful plants.
You know, that bale moderates everything that comes in from the outside and everything that goes from the inside out, because it just does. And so that is a good example of why we mulch stuff and why we do that. It moderates the effects of everything. So if you're doing a pretty good job, it will give you a pretty good result.
Oh, my goodness. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines and can get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. And certainly, if you haven't posted yet, comment in Shelley's memory on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I hope you will do that as well. And lots of people are doing that, and that's great. Judy and Delavan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. We took down a black walnut last year, storm damage. So I would love to plant a service berry. Do I have to wait 10 years for the jugwand to dissipate, or will service berry deal with that?
Boy, I don't have any problem with service berry and black walnut, but I don't know that I have planted it directly into the same spot that a black walnut was in. But I have them planted in my own yard around walnuts, and I have no issues whatsoever. I'm trying to pull out of the gray matter if there was anything that came across on that, and I don't recall anything.
We have a fact sheet on black walnut toxicity. Are you hooked up to the internet by any chance?
Well, no, not really.
Okay. What you could do is, if you want to give me a call at my office after the show, and what I can do is double check for you. We have a fact sheet. I just don't have access, and it's not one that I have memorized so that I know exactly which plants are sensitive to walnut toxins and which aren't. But I'm pretty sure that serviceberry is on that fact sheet, and it's in one of the two categories. I think it's in the tolerant category, so I think you should be fine. But I'd like to verify that before you go to the...
What's your number, by the way?
It's 608-262-2863.
And also, I would tell you that sometimes it can take longer than 10 years. I hate to tell you that.
Yeah.
But if you have an area where you've had walnuts for a very long time, depending on the soil and the movement of water through the soil and your replacement of organic matter, et cetera, on down the line, take all of those little pieces and put them together, that can mean that that jug loan will stay in the soil for longer than 10 years. And it goes out not just where the tree itself was planted, but it goes to the tip of the roots. So if it was a large tree, you're talking about a good 200-300 feet. And if you've got things that are growing fairly well with that really fell within that circumference, then you're probably okay. But again, I've got black walnuts in my yard. I have serviceberry next to them. They're fine. And they were young ones. So if they were going to die, they would have died already.
And I think you're safe with that, but I'd just like to double check. So if you'd like to give me a call, if you can't get a hold of me, just leave a voicemail message with your phone number and I'll give you a call back.
608-262-2863.
That's correct.
Okay. Mike and Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
I've tried to grow serrano peppers this past summer and had just miserable luck. And I'm wondering why. Last year, the year before, I had one bush that, you know, was on steroids. And this year, it was just
heat.
Very disappointing.
Heat. You know, again, we go to the heat at the time when they were blossoming and the pollination. And when we think about it, we think peppers really should be a lot more heat tolerant than they are. But everything has a weak point. And when things are blossoming, they are putting the most into that blossom. And if you've gotten your pepper plants from the same place all the time and you know that the health is good, or if you've grown them yourself from seed and you know that the seed is reliable and the health is good, if you've done, you know, as Larry said at the top of the show, if you do everything right, sometimes Mama Nature slaps you upside the head anyway. And this may have been last year, may have been what had happened, is that just hit at the wrong time.
Yeah. Were you seeing just no fruit production or were you seeing anything else? Did the rest of the plant look pretty normal?
Well, it looked kind of normal. It didn't have much growth to it as opposed to the year before.
But did you put it in the same place?
Yes.
Okay. You may want to rotate those things around a bit. Is it in a container or in the ground?
It was in the ground.
Okay.
Yeah, you want to rotate things around because every plant will pull specific nutrients out of the soil. And if you put that same type of plant in the same spot all the time, without replacing nutrients,
It was heavily fertilized with horseshit.
Oh, okay. When did you heavily fertilize it? Early in the season or mid-season?
Well, earlier in the season.
Okay, because that can actually impact when you fertilize. Can actually impact the development of blossoms as well. So if it was a heavy nutrient provision at a time when it really should have been producing blossoms, that fertilizer could have gone into vegetative growth as opposed to fruit and blossom development. So you may have had kind of like triple whammy stuff going on there. I still would rotate whether you add fertilizer or not. It just is a good way to prevent. It's a small thing to do to prevent the development of insects and diseases specific to species.
You can get a buildup of disease-causing organisms in the soil if you continually plant the same type of plant in an area, and also relatives. So peppers are related to things like tomatoes and potatoes and eggplants. So you need to be careful that you don't grow those crops kind of in the same area all the time as well.
But do you have a large garden or is it fairly small?
I have a small area
that
I can use for vegetables, and so that's
Okay. Yeah. Do you have much any space for containers?
Yeah, I've got containers. Space on a deck.
You know, I absolutely love using vegetables in containers around the back door. I put in tomatoes right next to the back door, and the ones that I put in are those little cherry ones that produce so many you want to just rip them out after the first week. Well, I find if you put them by the door, people grab them as they go by, you know, and it's just an easy thing. The same thing with peppers.
Peppers would do really well in containers.
Because they love the heat on their roots. And so pick a nice hot container that you can fry other stuff in, and the peppers would probably be happy, just happy.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling in, Mike. Appreciate your call. And Jan in La Crosse, I want to get to Jan. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Really enjoy your program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We have grapevines, and they are the Concord grape seedless. And they were last year were just loaded. And then one day I went out there, and every grape was gone. Someone called about this last year, and this happened last year too. There are no grapes on the ground. We put a netting over the entire thing, and we still, it just like it's magic or something horrible like that. And it just, they're gone.
They're gone.
They're gone, totally. They're,
I remember I it from last year this happened.
Yes. And I look, you look on the ground around it and everything, and you, there's got to be a grape dropped.
Well, you would think so. Now, you don't have neighbors that come in and pick your grapes. They don't look like they were cut, do they?
They wouldn't know, and they would have an awful time getting through that netting. I mean, it would take them a half a day.
Yeah, it has to be, you know, when I look at things, that nothing is left at the end of this rampage. That really limits the amount of critters that can do that, that can actually get in and do that. Woodchucks can get up and in and climb over and, you know, burrow and do whatever. But they're typically kind of messy and they'll leave stuff behind. So you would notice, you know, they would leave one grape that didn't taste quite as good. So I have no idea.
Other than chipmunks or something of that sort.
Chipmunks would too, and they do clean up very, very nicely. Squirrels tend to leave a little bit of a mess. So I'm
suspicious of small animals of some kind, but I can't tell you exactly what.
It wouldn't have been an insect or a disease. We can eliminate those two things. But aside from that, I have no idea.
No, we don't either.
I wish we could help you out, but I'm afraid we can't, Jan. I'm really sorry. Mm-hmm. I wish we could.
I know. I wish I had a better answer than I don't
camera.
Know.
Setting up a cam out there to watch to see what's out there.
You know, they have fantastic, reasonably priced cameras that you can strapped almost anything.
And do infrared so you can see things at night.
Yep.
That would be a lot of fun to do. And I think a lot of people, you don't have to be a hunter.
No.
You just put something like that out in your backyard, you'd be amazed at the
animals.
Yeah. Yes. The amount of activity that goes on in a backyard.
Amazed and probably slightly appalled.
Well, here we are out of time. I want to thank you guys so much for being with us. I hope you will come back and be with us again.
Certainly. If you'd like us back, we'd be happy to come back.
Yeah, if you can tolerate us, I'm happy to come back.
Well, we had someone call and say, you had such wonderful guests today. So that was very
sweet.
Thank you.
Well, you have wonderful listeners. It makes it easy to be on this end.
Lots of great questions.
Always.
Lots of great questions. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison and the Department of Plant Pathology, Liz Freemuth, who is the owner of her business, The Garden Whole, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticultural services. So it's great to have them with us. And it was really nice to be able to say a word or two about our dear friend, Shelley Ryan, who passed away on Thursday at 9 a.m. And, of course, our wishes and prayers go to her family. She is going to be very much missed. And if you haven't already done so, and lots of people have, I hope you'll post a comment on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. There's a spot for comments that I'm sure her husband Denny's going to and her son are really going to appreciate. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.